We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 151.
On today's show, we talk about ancient shipwrecks, a rediscovered African-American cemetery, and Neanderthal impacts on the Pleistocene landscape.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everyone. How's it going?
Pretty good.
So, not that we re-record these like at the last minute or anything, but it is Christmas Eve. So for anyone that cares, Merry Christmas.
Yes. Yeah. You know, when it's the holidays, sometimes time gets away from you.
Plus, I've been sick all this week. I get sick like once every couple of years, I feel like really sick, and thought I had COVID Monday. Took an in-home test. I don't know how accurate those are with whole Omicron coming out, but I didn't really have COVID symptoms. Other side, some lung stuff going on, but that only lasted like a day, and now I've just had like a cough and stuff for the week. So, anyway, wasn't really conducive to recording.
No, definitely not. I bet your voice still sounds a little
low.
Different. Yeah.
I'll be editing out coughs throughout this entire episode for your benefit.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. So we got three articles that have nothing to do with Christmas or the holidays.
Nope.
And in fact, we talked about it. There's so many articles out there that already basically summarize current thinking in archaeology and history around different aspects of, say, Christmas, this holiday season, you know, that whole thing. Didn't really feel the need to, I guess, rehash that.
No, and I think we mentioned in the last episode, there's like a lot of pseudoscience around it too.
That's
where like people supporting the Christian biblical version of events kind of, they bend the archaeology to their will and to show what they want. So we just don't even want to jump into that, that sphere at all.
Instead, let's talk about shipwrecks.
Yeah, totally. Shipwrecks are awesome.
So,
I mean, maybe they weren't awesome when they happened, they're awesome now.
Probably not. So we're going to talk about two shipwrecks that were reported in one article, basically, and they were found by the Marine Archaeology Unit of the Israel Antiquities Authority. And, I mean, what was found, we'll just get that out of the way, hundreds of silver and bronze coins, silver and gold rings, rare gems, figurines, and bells.
It's like a treasure trove. It's exactly what you think of when, like, you're watching a movie about a shipwreck discovery or something, right? Like, this is it.
I know, pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So it was found off the coast of a place called Caesarea. Basically, it looks like it literally translates to like Caesar's place.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
You know? That's how it's spelled. Mm-hmm. The cool thing is these shipwrecks are basically right next to each other, but they went down over 1,000 years apart from each other.
Yeah. So crazy.
So they went down. One was 1,700 years ago during what they called the Roman period, and one was 600 years ago during the Mamluk period, which we'll talk about a little bit later. Mm-hmm. And they were found in a depth of only 13 feet.
I know, isn't that crazy? But I was reading that it sounds like they might have been anchored there, like probably to wait out a storm or something, and the storm just sort of did them in, so it didn't work. They hoped, but it didn't work. And I guess this must have been a place that was sort of a safe harbor for lots of storms throughout the years, which is why you get such wildly different shipwrecks.
Well, yeah, another thing that the article mentioned that said, you know, sailors basically should know that if you anticipate a storm and you park in shallow water, like, you're going to get hammered.
Right? Oh, really?
You need to be in deeper water.
Oh.
Yeah, because your ship can ride the swells of deeper water, but the crashing waves and the potential for grounding is just terrible. So they're not really sure, you know, why they would have chosen to park here knowing a storm was coming.
Maybe it came too quickly or something.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe they were, you know, being held for COVID-1 and they were just anchored out there and then a storm happened.
Like quarantined, you know, or something.
Yeah, they were quarantined.
Yeah, maybe. Well, in the water today is 13 feet, but it might have been different at that time, correct?
It could have been a little bit different. Probably not a whole lot.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so the archaeologists were taking a look here, and I don't know what prompted them to go there. It was probably found, probably bits and pieces had been found, but the ships were there and all their stuff was there. But aside from all the jewels and things like that, They also found some personal effects, and those included an inkwell, a bronze figurine in the form of an eagle, a figurine of a Roman pantomimus. I don't really know. In a comic mask, numerous bronze bells, pottery vessels, dozens of large bronze nails, lead pipes from a bilge pump. That's super cool.
Yeah.
And a large iron anchor. So that's all really neat.
Yeah. Those are really unique things to find, I think, especially with a shipwreck. So that's cool that they found all that.
Well, it's pretty clear that, like, things were not taken off the ship. Either people were just not on there, and maybe there was a skeleton crew like on watch while it was sitting at anchor, or everybody just bailed and everything went with it.
Yeah.
You know, when they crashed down. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, if it's in such short water or shallow water, there would have been people that could easily go down 13 feet and start picking stuff up off the bottom. So,
like salvage after the.
Yeah. I'm wondering why, with so many precious things on board. Like, why didn't they go try to find it? I don't know.
Well, but 13 feet. Okay, so 600 years ago and 1700 years ago, 13 feet. Like, you got to have an expert diver who can hold breath for a really long time.
Yeah, that's par for the course of people that lived by the sea back then.
I know, but I think that is kind of a big ask. They probably salvaged what they could, but, you know, they weren't able to get all of it.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, who knows what else was there, right?
Yeah.
Some other cool things they found. There was a red gemstone for setting in what's called a Gemma ring. Hmm. The carving of the gemstone shows a lyre. In Jewish tradition, this is called a Kinor David. It's K-I-N-O-R, so I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but Kinor David. Okay. It obviously translates to like King David.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I've never heard of that. That's cool.
It's kind
of
neat.
Also, they found a thick octagonal gold ring set with a green gemstone that is carved with the figure of a young shepherd boy dressed in a tunic and bearing a ram or a sheep on his shoulders. And that was like the coolest thing in the whole article, I think, in my opinion. It was just so neat. The ring itself is beautiful. Like, I would totally wear it today. And then the gemstone having that carving on it. So, like, it's sort of like a big oval shape. And then it's this really intricately carved figure in the center of the oval. Really, really beautiful. And I wonder, well, I guess the image represents like the Good Shepherd. It's one of the earliest and oldest images used in Christianity for symbolizing Jesus. I don't know if they mentioned which shipwreck that one came from, or if they could tell if the shipwrecks were that close together. But I suppose it would have had to have been the Mamluk one, right?
I mean, possibly. Why not 1700 years ago?
Yeah. I guess that could be the Roman one. Yeah.
So
anyway, it's really beautiful. If you have a chance to check out the links, you should definitely go look at the picture of it. It was really cool looking.
So a little bit on the Mamluk period, because I'd never heard of it.
Yeah, that was new to me too.
And this is going to be a really quick bullet point, high level overview of what that was, because in different areas, it kind of meant different things, like variations on this same theme, right? And what this period really meant. But the Mamluk period refers to Mamluks, and or Mamluks, there was another pronunciation, and there's a few different ways to say it. But they were basically non-Arab, ethnically diverse, basically anybody who's not an Arab, slave soldiers and freed slaves. Mm. Okay, that was this class of people, basically. They were assigned military and administrative duties and served Arab dynasties in the Muslim world, typically.
Oh, okay.
They were really powerful in like Egypt and, in other places. But this concept of the like slave soldier and basically slave soldier being able to ascend to different ranks and have certain powers, but still essentially a slave.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you want to look at it.
Reminds me of Game of Thrones a little bit.
I know. Yeah. I mean, current military, you're not a slave necessarily, but you are told where to live, where to go, what to do.
Yeah. And it's a job, but
you make a choice to be that way. Yeah. Whereas these people didn't make a choice.
Yeah.
You know, they probably were into this and then were put in the system and it's just like, okay, this is my job now.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole period of basically doing this endured for nearly 1,000 years, from the 9th to the 19th centuries.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's a long time.
Yeah. That's insane. In some areas, this was like a knightly ruling class, similar to like British knights kind of things.
Oh.
So they're basically, you know, again, sworn soldiers, but higher ranking.
Mm-hmm.
So that was in various Muslim societies. And some even attained the rank of sultan in the area. Sultan is kind of like a governor.
Yeah, right.
There were other ranks too, like imam and others that are a little bit lower in the Muslim societies. But it's so crazy to me that they could attain these political and influential ranks, and yet they're still kind of basically slaves.
Yeah, but there, it sounds like they're slaves more to the government and the society rather to an individual or a person. And because of that, I think it means that they were able to grow into higher ranks. I guess that kind of makes sense in some ways. So, yeah, that's cool. Maybe it wasn't great for them, but it is interesting. And it's interesting that they had a ship full of really valuable items that they lost in this this storm whenever it happened as well.
Right. All right. Well, let's go from slaves on that side of the world to slaves on this side of the world and their unfortunate descendants and our treatment of them in certain places in regards to a forgotten black cemetery found in Florida. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 151. And we are talking about cemeteries.
Yeah, I love cemeteries.
Yeah, except for sad cemeteries.
Yeah, I don't like when they're sad. I guess they're kind of sad, depending on your perspective of the cemetery. But yeah. I do love a good amble through a old cemetery, but moving on.
I don't amble enough.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know.
That's what you do in cemeteries, though.
Amble.
Don't shake your head at me.
Amble, what a dumb
if
word.
If you guys could only see how he's shaking his head at me.
What a dumb word, amble. Makes no sense. Anyway, words lost all meaning. All right, so we're in Clearwater, Florida. This is in Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. Tampa Bay is just a sprawling metropolis of a city followed by many, many, many small neighborhoods and cities around it and towns. And Clearwater is one of those. And at the site of a downtown office building, an unmarked African-American cemetery was found.
Mm-hmm. Found or rediscovered, I would say, right?
Well, I mean, it was found and rediscovered.
People knew it was there, and they knew it was there not that long ago, too.
Yeah, actually, that's the thing. There's not a lot of people that are alive right now that were really truly aware of the cemetery. Mm-hmm. Obviously there were people that were born around them. We're going to talk about one in a minute, but they were like young and didn't care about cemeteries. Right.
Yeah.
So all the old people that did care about cemeteries and buried people there are long since gone.
Right. So this is probably two generations removed, right? So maybe you don't know anybody buried there, but you know of somebody who knew somebody that was buried there basically.
I mean, we're in the time period where unless you have direct written evidence of it, like, there's not very many people that actually were aware of and are like, hey, where's the cemetery?
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
And there's some other shenanigans that happened, too. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But this cemetery contains hundreds of graves, they think. It's actually not been completely excavated.
Right.
So, and it's at least the fourth abandoned African-American cemetery that's been rediscovered in recent years in Florida. So basically, in Florida, and probably other parts of the South and honestly the Eastern United States, in the 1950s, the mid-1950s, the post-war era, it was a very prosperous time. People seemed to have lots of money. They're making babies and they're
building boom,
you know, having a good time. So there were a lot of people moving to Florida, a lot of people moving to the Tampa Bay area. It's a very sought-after place for people to be because it's, you know, right on the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah.
It's got beautiful sandy beaches and it's just a nice place to go.
Yeah.
So as they were needing space for white people to come down, they started moving black neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that would get moved in a black neighborhood is a black African-American cemetery.
Well, a church, actually. The church would move.
Yeah, yeah.
And the cemetery wouldn't necessarily go with it. but they were building on that land. So what happens to the cemetery when you move the church?
Yeah.
It just gets paved over.
Yeah, and there's records of the developer who originally developed in this spot having been told, hey, you got to move this cemetery. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, okay, we'll get on that and we'll move the cemetery. You know, they were going to move the graves. And apparently some of them were moved, right? Some of them were moved. But then they just kept finding them. And I guess I get the impression the cemetery wasn't like super well organized to begin with. It was probably really old.
Yeah.
And, you know, old cemeteries, it doesn't matter where they are or what's going on. Unless they're like the Queen's Cemetery, it's just like there's sections of it that are super old and not probably in the best condition.
Yeah, it kind of jumbled together.
Yeah.
So I have a little bit of experience working on like cemetery recovery, basically. I worked on this project in New Jersey where we were moving a cemetery from the 1800s, 17 and 1800s. Mm-hmm. And they knew it was there and it had been paved over, just like this situation. But it was in the early 2000s, of course, and they are subject to the laws that we have today that don't allow you to just ignore a cemetery that's under the ground. It forces you to excavate it and move it. And in this case, it had been paved over. And what they did when they paved it over is they just like bulldozed the headstones down too.
Oh,
and at one point in the excavation that I was a part of, they uncovered like a bulldozed pile of headstones from the 50s when they originally paved over that cemetery.
Oh man.
Like they were in terrible condition. They were in chunks So like that's how they were treating it back in those times before they had laws that required them to treat these sort of resources in a certain way.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. So whatever prompted this basically CRM project, I'm guessing some renovations were happening or something was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And archaeologists came in there and they first used ground penetrating radar to see what was under the ground. And that's how they started finding graves. Mm-hmm. Right? They started finding a lot of graves.
Yep.
And archaeologists actually believe that several hundred people may still be buried there. And when I say there, it's a parking lot.
Yeah.
It's literally under the parking lot that they're finding these people with ground penetrating radar. GPR is really good at finding graves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have very a good. Really solid signature to them, especially graves that, you know, to be honest, aren't that old. Now, one thing that surprises me is Florida is like pure sand and sand is terrible at organics.
Yeah.
It's acidic and it just tears things apart. So I'm kind of surprised that even graves that are, you know, the fresh ones that would have been put in the 50s before it was destroyed, those would have been the newest graves. I'm honestly surprised that some of the older ones even are represented in the GPR signature anymore. But it's probably the hardware and stuff on the caskets.
That's what I was just going to say. I can call back to my New Jersey cemetery recovery experience again. And we would find what's called the coffin line. Mm-hmm. And you would get this dark outline, like in the shape of a rectangular box. And you could follow that outline all the way around with your trowel. And then you would know that you had the boundary of the coffin and that there were probably remains of some sort inside.
Yeah.
But depending on the soil, it's very individual. Like the soil could be really great in one spot and have great preservation, and by great I mean less acidic probably,
sure,
and then very acidic and very poor preservation in other areas, and you would just find like pieces of the larger, more dense bones, like the skull and maybe sometimes pieces of the pelvis, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like it really depended on the soil, but there were things that you could find. The coffin line was always there because wood just lasted a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hardware, of course, too. You could often find that if there was any.
Yeah, for sure. Well, the finding of these old cemeteries and neighborhoods and evidence of communities that are no longer there is forcing the communities that are there now to kind of come to terms with their, you know, history of racist policies.
Yeah.
That targeted these neighborhoods.
Yep, definitely.
And, you know, this kind of expansion that can largely be blamed on white people, to be honest. And I say white people, it's really... I mean, it is a racist idea, but it is really the people in power at the time.
Yeah.
You know, they happen to be white people. And before African Americans and during the African American, you know, slave times and then post-slave era, it was African Americans and Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Like anybody that needed to be moved, they would just move. Mm-hmm. Right. They're just like, listen, we're coming in, we're building a fancy resort and you're getting out.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just how it is.
Yep.
I would love to see an alternate timeline or maybe a futuristic timeline where... I mean, I hate to promote racism, but man, it would just be interesting to see from somebody's perspective if the tables turned in like 100 years or 200 years. I would like to think that we'd get beyond that kind of thing in 200 years.
Yeah.
We wouldn't.
I know. I would hope that the damage done to the current minorities in this country would show that we shouldn't treat anybody that way.
Yeah.
But that's having a lot of hope in humanity. And
yeah,
you know what? It's Christmas Eve. I'm going to have hope. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
Here's the hope.
Christmas is all about fiction. So you
oh,
do you.
My God,
anyway,
so
there's a woman named Barbara Sori Love. That's a hyphenated last name. She's a Clearwater native. She was born in the basement of Clearwater's hospital. Of course, in the basement.
Of course.
She's African-American. 69 years ago, she grew up in Clearwater Heights, which is a neighborhood that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. As she says back then, you know, they were all called colored people still back in mm-hmm. the 50s. And she's quoted as saying that's where the colored mothers and children were housed. It was in Clearwater Heights.
Clearwater Heights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So were housed too, like not like lived, but were placed.
Maybe it was like a public housing kind of a thing.
I guess.
Or,
yeah.
Yeah.
A few years ago, she helped form the Clearwater Heights Reunion Committee, a group of people that grew up in the neighborhood. And them and officials are basically trying to figure out what to do. I mean, to the mm-hmm. credit of the people who live and govern the area now, they are concerned. They're like, okay, what do we do about this? You know, we can't really tear down the office building and the parking lot. I mean, they could strip up the parking lot, but I mean, it's definitely some financial resources that have to be pulled together to be able to do this. But mm-hmm. and realistically now, given the setting, it would be probably unlikely that the cemetery would be reestablished there. More likely, they'd still have to remove the graves, rebury them somewhere else, and
yeah.
probably put up some kind of a memorial
yeah.
on the site that memorializes the people that are there. But that's the other problem is they don't even know who's there.
Right.
Like, it's poorly documented. The church is gone.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know where the church records are, but it's all, you know, like, what's going on?
Yeah. So here's the thing about this situation. Having the original surface being either paved over or having a building built on top of it,
mm-hmm.
it actually has preserved those graves
yeah.
way better than just having them under the ground exposed.
They haven't been weathered?
No, there's no weather.
Yeah.
I mean, pavement is a great like protection.
Yeah.
Obviously, I am not a member of this Black community and
yeah.
I don't know how they feel about it. However, from a preservation standpoint, leaving them right where they are and then putting up some kind of memorial so people know that they're there and why they're there and why this building company from the 50s chose to just not move the graves like they were supposed to. That's the real problem. And that should be addressed in some sort of memorial.
And that brings up another person involved with this, Antoinette Jackson, who's an anthropologist from the University of South Florida. She helped create the Black Cemetery Network, which is a website and organization that is trying to help link African-American cemeteries that are being rediscovered mm-hmm. with communities that they belonged to.
Oh, yeah. Right? And maybe like records from churches
right.
and things so that you can know who's actually buried there.
Yeah. They want to
really
try to
cool.
find images of people, stories about them,
mm-hmm.
the people themselves, information about them in the communities that they lived in and put them on the map, basically
yeah, yeah.
put them in the public domain. So when you're talking about putting up a memorial, I mean, yeah, you can say here lies an African-American cemetery. We have no idea who's here,
mm-hmm.
but it would be better to say here lies an African-American cemetery and here's all the names of the people that
yeah,
are there.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
When you put names and even like faces and stuff like that and histories to people, it just, the more information you have, the more real it becomes for
yeah.
people in the area.
Yeah,
so,
definitely.
You know, also, it's kind of a good thing it's an office building because nobody wants to be living on a burial ground. I don't care who's buried there. Like, people just get weird about that.
I think that's awesome.
I don't know. Poltergeist. So, did you ever see Poltergeist?
No.
Oh, man.
I don't like scary movies.
I mean, it's not scary.
And I don't believe in any of that nonsense
well,
either.
Listen,
so.
Little girls and their demons screaming at you from the white noise on
no,
a TV.
I'm not into that.
Like in a suburb in Phoenix, I think
no,
it was.
No,
there's nothing wrong with that.
Not happening. I don't need that in my life.
It's so bad. I think it was literally built on a Native American burial ground. And like that caused
oh,
demons
the movie?
Or something.
Oh.
Yeah, something
Ooh.
Like that. It was really terrible.
Oh, man. Wouldn't that be fun to like deconstruct?
Like old racist movies.
Yes. From an anthropological perspective.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my gosh.
All right.
Yeah.
Next on the APN.
Oh my God.
Right. Anyway, there's a bill in Congress right now. Again, there's a lot of stuff tied to this, but it's called the it's a bill that's trying to create the African American Burial Grounds Network, and it would be under the direction of the National Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, twice now, this bill has gained support and gone through and tried to get signed. I honestly don't know like where it's at right now and how that's happening, but somebody affiliated with that, with the congressperson that was trying to push this forward, because it has to be sponsored by, I think, two congresspersons.
Right.
And one of their aides reached out to a bunch of networks, and the Archaeology Podcast Network was one of them. And we are signatories to the bill both ways.
That's really awesome.
Or we're sponsors. I don't know what we technically are, but
we're supporting it.
There's a supporting letter. Yeah. And then there's logos and names of a bunch of organizations that are part of it. Mm-hmm. Like Society for American Archaeology is on there. You know, a bunch of places are on there. And then the APN logo is right on there too. So,
Yep. That's cool. That's very cool.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's gaining steam in a number of different areas, locally and nationally, which means, you know, the more visibility you have on that, the more something's likely to get done.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yep. All right. Well, we started with landscape modification in Tampa Bay. Let's see how Neanderthals modified their landscape in Germany a few years before that.
Just a couple. Back in a minute.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Welcome back to the third and final Christmas Eve segment of the Archaeology Show. Actually, it's after Christmas when you're listening to this. So
yes, it is.
Hopefully you had a great day. You had some eggnog. Oh, we're having eggnog tonight.
Yeah,
I make homemade eggnog every year.
Yep. It's delicious.
It's great. I didn't make up the recipe. I found it like a decade ago and I've been using it every year since.
Yeah, so, it's a good one.
Anyway, back to science. This article... it's not an article at all. Actually, there might be some articles about this if you can find them, but we're linking to the paper that is open access in Science Advances.
Yeah.
And I will tell you right now.
It's meaty.
There's a lot to this. It basically comes to essentially one conclusion, but they really lay out all the evidence towards it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, I would tell you right now, go right to the bottom of the article before the references and download the supplemental information, which include a couple of the figures that are in here. But I think there's a figure or two that aren't in here. And then some tables as well that will help you. Because actually some of the figures and stuff represent the information. Or mention the information that's in the supplemental material.
Make it easier to understand, basically.
Yeah, totally. So a little note before we go on, because, you know, sometimes we share actual scholarly articles. And again, they can be a little hard to read because they're written for a certain audience. And that audience is not most of us.
Yeah.
So advice that I was given a long time ago that I still follow today is read the abstract. The abstract should tell you the premise behind it, like what they were trying to do. A little bit about how they did it and a little bit about what they actually found. Mm-hmm. The abstract is literally the entire article.
Yeah.
So you should know all about this by reading that. And if you want more information, you read the article. Now, don't probably start reading at the introduction paragraph one, because most articles are written by first laying out the issue. What are we trying to find here? What's going on? And then they'll talk about past research, who's already done research in this area.
Yeah.
And then they'll start talking about their research methods and where they went, and then an analysis and discussion of what they found they did the research. Yeah, that's very jargon heavy.
Yeah.
And then at the end, they'll usually have some kind of conclusion, although they usually call it either a conclusion or something like that. But this one actually calls it results. I was thinking actually results was more along the lines of analysis of their methods, but this one calls it results. And the results even is still pretty thick. And then there's actually a final, well, it's not results, it's discussion. Discussion is where you need to look if you want to really read what they found as an analysis and a discussion of their results.
Like interpretation, basically, of what they found.
I was a little confused on this because the final segment is actually called Materials and Methods.
What?
And that seems out of place to me.
This
discussion should be the last one.
This is done by a non-American company or group of researchers,
from the Netherlands. Yeah,
yeah. Maybe they just order their things differently.
No, they have to follow the format of wherever they're publishing, right? Yeah. They have a certain publication format. Maybe this is Science Direct's way of doing it. I don't really know, but it's weird.
Either way, all we're saying is you probably don't need to read this. we'll tell you all about it.
Yeah.
Right now.
If you want to look at it, what I was getting to is read the abstract, look at the figures, and read the figure captions.
Yeah.
And then go straight down to not methods and materials, but the discussion and see if you can read that. Maybe skim it.
Yep.
Maybe read the last couple of paragraphs of it. If you want to know more information, then continue on and read the full article. Mm-hmm. But I don't want you to get disheartened by starting at the beginning and going, I don't understand anything here, and then, you know, not read any of it. So, or just listen to the next eight or 9 minutes of us talking about it.
That's what I did. And then you read it for me. And then you told me all about it. It was great.
There we go. So let's talk about it. We're talking about landscape modification by Neanderthals.
Mm-hmm.
First off, we do not know much about how Pleistocene, and Pleistocene dates from, my God, what is it, like 12 or so thousand years ago to like 150,000 years ago?
It's a huge time span.
I mean, it's a massive span of time, yeah. It's basically a whole time span that is defined by glacial advances and retreats.
Right.
Yeah, all over the world. Mm-hmm. So, well, Northern Hemisphere anyway. We do not know much about how early hunter-gatherer groups, because we didn't really have like band and tribes and even state-level societies and stuff like that. We didn't really have bands and tribes and stuff like that until, you know, the last 8, 9, 10,000 years. Mm-hmm. And before that, it really was just smaller hunter-gatherer groups, right? They didn't really organize in that way. So we don't know how they impacted their ecosystems.
Right.
Did they participate in deforestation? Did they dam up rivers? Did they, you know, how did they affect the landscape in a way that might be seen in the archaeological record?
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of assumptions that it was just like roaming bands of people who never stayed in one place long enough to really have much of an impact.
Right.
That, and it might be a good assumption, but this article is kind of poking holes in that theory a little bit, which is what made it really interesting.
Yeah, and one of the reasons behind this kind of a study is the definition of the Anthropocene. And mm-hmm. I mentioned that in this article because the Anthropocene is a geological era that has been defined as the time period with which humanity mm-hmm. has been making a permanent impact on the landscape.
Right.
And you can look and see, or you can supposedly look and see in geological layers and say, okay, this is where humans started having an impact.
Right.
Right. And some of those have been more recently defined as evidence of pollution, basically, from the Industrial Revolution.
Carbon emissions and stuff like that, right?
Mid to late 1800s when that really started to really have an impact.
It.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy that you can see that in the geological record in some mm-hmm. cases, but there's other stuff you can see in the ground as well. And that's what this article is talking about. So,
yeah, because the evidence of people having an impact on the geology of the world, it goes back to basically whenever modern humans started getting bigger mm-hmm. and having a bigger impact on their landscape. So this article is really interesting because it could potentially push that back even more. I don't know if they would change, they being the scientist
the
gods.
Collective group of scientists, yeah.
I don't know if they would actually change the ending of the Pleistocene and the beginning of the Anthropocene.
Yeah.
Anthropocene period. But potentially, if we know that Neanderthals are having a bigger impact on the landscape than we thought, then maybe they do need to reanalyze when that starts.
Well, the interesting thing is the Pleistocene, again, is defined by a separate thing. And the Anthropocene would, if anything,
overlap, maybe?
Yeah, be an overlapping geological time period. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
okay, but we're like jumping ahead, though. We should probably talk about what this article actually found.
Right. So what they were looking at was a landscape, basically a lake landscape, they called it, in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And the place is called Neumark Nord Lake Basin. And you can look in the article to find out exactly where that's at. But what this area is it was in an area 125,000 years ago mm-hmm. that, from my best reading of this, looks like it was covered in glaciers for a lot of time, but for about an 11,000 year period, there was a glacial retreat and the basin was open
mm-hmm.
and then the glaciers advanced again and covered it again.
Okay.
So, or it was uninhabitable mm-hmm. in some way because of glaciers.
11,000 years though.
It's an 11,000 year span.
That's a pretty long span. Like that's enough time for
stuff to happen.
Yeah. For stuff to happen for sure. Yeah.
And what did happen was eventually Neanderthals and they think probably other early human groups, because there would have been early humans. They're calling it hominins. If you see hominin in the discussion here or in the paper, hominin just refers to any Homo group.
Right.
Right. And Homo Neanderthalensis, Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, And actually, to be honest, I think, what is it? Homo erectus even goes into that time frame, I think. And then there's some others that are like, there's Denisovians and there's all kinds of, I don't think they're that old, that young. But anyway, there's a lot of different things that we don't even know. But human-like groups, basically, hominins. Anyway, they eventually came into the area. It was a very fertile area. All the glacial areas are because there's a lot of sediment there. And it's just a really good place for things to grow. And animals would be flocking back to that area, therefore bringing people with them, right? Neanderthals or whatever. I'm just going to say people. And there's really solid evidence, archaeological evidence, exemplified by butchered animal bones, over 20,000 stone artifacts, and evidence of fire building that lasted a continuous 2,000 years.
Yeah.
So when people got there, they stayed there for 2,000 years, which is an incredibly long time.
It's very long, I mean, that doesn't even happen in modern worlds half the time, you know?
Yeah, so they were looking at all of the ecological evidence around in the area, trying to find out, well, how can we tell if they had an impact on the landscape? You know, I don't think that was a primary thrust of the study. That's just one of the things that came out about this when they're doing all their studies. And one of the ways they were able to do this is by looking at ancient lake cores from the lake is there. And the lake cores, well, the layers that you can see in a lake core are called varves. Okay. And it's V-A-R-V-E-S. And varves are basically laid down seasonally when, you know, rain basically has, and dust and normal things, has little particulates of, you know, dirt, sand, sediment, you know, whatever, sediment. And it lays on the surface of the lake and then falls down to the lake bottom. And there's a lot more of, including pollen, and there's a lot more of that, obviously, in the spring and summer than, say, the fall and the winter. So that really thick layer that gets laid down then then settles over the winter when less stuff falls, and then another layer goes on top of it, and the next year another layer goes on top of it, and you end up with this stratigraphy that's so basically cool. Every year.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
Never even thought about that, but of course you see stuff blowing into the lake or settling on the lake. If you just think about, you know, going to a modern lake now, you'd see that happening. So that is so cool.
Yeah. So they took these layers of varves from these cores, and using various techniques, and they really go in depth with it in the paper, but using various techniques, they were able to line up these seasonal sequences with actual time periods and these pollen sequences, looking at, you know, different species of plants and trees, doing some actual dating and doing some stuff. They were able to line it up with the sequence of time that actually this fits. And then they started looking at the actual areas where humans were living right there and the areas outside of that. And by making a comparison in the trees and the pollen and the vegetation, they were able to pretty clearly state that A, humans were burning fires pretty much continuously that whole time. And B, to burn those fires, they cut down all the forests.
Yeah.
So the whole place was basically deforested to a point that they could tell it was deforested.
Because there was less pollen basically in those layers.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's my question. Is it possible that there were natural fires that were doing this and it wasn't human created?
I would say yes, theoretically. Mm-hmm. But when you don't see that in the other 8,000 or 9,000 years, and you see it dramatically during a 2,000 year span.
When you know humans were there.
When you know humans were there and you can correlate that with their tools and other identified artifacts.
Yep.
That's pretty clear that humans caused it.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah. So they take all these lines of evidence, and that's what real archaeology does, I think. Archaeology is just one facet of anthropology, and it's one part of the science that is really the digging and the finding of things, and then that synthesis, bringing it all together, and this multidisciplinary study is what really makes a good research paper and a good analysis. Because, you know, like, we do archaeology, but we try to come up with all these, you know, things, and we say this stuff on site records. But to be honest, there's so many more pieces to the puzzle that we just don't have.
Yeah.
And you need to bring in other people if you really want to tell a story.
Yeah. Like, if you're really trying to draw conclusions from an archaeological dig, you need so many more pieces of information to support the conclusion that you're getting to, the story that you're telling. And a lot of it is geological. I don't think archaeologists spend enough time on learning about the geology a lot of times. So, yeah, but the geology and all that is so, so important, as this paper is showing, because I never would have even thought about looking at layers of pollen in a lake bed. That is so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yep.
There's a lot of stuff they can tell by looking at the varves. The varves.
Yeah, varves are my new favorite thing.
I feel like that's like a punk band or something. The varves.
The varves.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's really neat.
Anyway, super cool. Check out the paper. You might be able to search the headline of the paper and find some more popular articles that have been written about it that kind of do a more distilled synthesis of the research.
Yeah.
But a lot of cool things in there. So, well, I think that's it for this week and this year. This is our last episode of 2021.
Oh my God, it totally is.
Yeah, because our next episode, hopefully you're listening to us on a nice, calm Sunday morning, and your hangover should be mostly gone by then, because it's the 2nd.
Because it's January 2nd.
Yeah. So hopefully you're doing all right. You're starting 2022 off with the Archaeology Show and kicking it into high gear.
Yep, definitely.
All right. Well, hopefully you had a good Christmas if you celebrate that, or you just had a great Saturday if you don't. And we'll see you in 2022.
Adios.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.